medicine was deported, their crops and their forage were destroyed. So were their homes, which were burned. There is no final list of how many innocent people died in the process, although some estimates suggest it surpassed the carnage in Lawrence. Nor is the list of total refugees in this mass exodus fully complete. In one town, the population dwindled from 10,000 to a mere 600. But what is complete is this. Few of these refugees returned before the war's end. Many never did. When it was all over, these Midwestern counties lay like a silent wasteland, dotted by chimneys rising above the charred debris of blackened farmhouses. Thus escalated the vicious cycle of retaliation and revenge. For the next 6 weeks, Quantrill and the partisans skirmished. Yet despite a massive sweep through the woodlands of western Missouri by federal cavalrymen, Quantrill escaped. He and his men knew the countryside personally, and friends and relatives provided them with shelter, fresh horses, and timely warning in case of pursuit. In a telling instance of the relative ease with which guerrillas operated, Quantrill himself spent much of the time in comfort, neatly residing at a house near Blue Springs with his mistress, Kate King. On October 6, his gang again struck with considerable fury, overcoming a federal wagon train at Baxter Springs. They mauled and killed 85 men, including the band musicians and James O'Neill, an artist for Frank Leslie's illustrated newspaper. So great was the wave of disgust over this bloodletting that news of the guerrilla war in the West actually supplanted, temporarily at least, the clash of armies in the East. Even Confederate generals were dismayed at the wanton carnage. Noted one high-ranking military man in Richmond, "They recognize the life of a man less than you would that of a dog killing a sheep." At one point, a desperate Union, unsure of how to deal with the guerrillas, went as far as consulting Francis Lieber, the famous legal scholar. Lieber's message was hardly reassuring. While distinguishing between regular and irregular partisans, he grimly likened the guerrilla war to the 30 Years' War and the religious wars in France. And he coined a most ominous phrase. "Where guerrillas flourish," he noted, "they create a slaughter field." The slaughter field was destined to grow even worse. The Union soldiers hunted the guerrillas like animals, and in return, they too eventually degenerated into little more than savage beasts, driven by a viciousness unimaginable just 2 years earlier. By 1864, the guerrilla war had reached new peaks of savagery, robbing stagecoaches, harassing citizens, cutting telegraph wires were everyday occurrences. But now it was no longer simply enough to ambush and gun down the enemy. They had to be mutilated and, just as often, scalped. When that was no longer enough, the dead were stripped and castrated. In time, even that was insufficient. Then the victims were beheaded, and even that wasn't enough. So ears were cut off, faces were hacked, bodies were grossly mangled. Soon, Quantrill and his men rode about wearing scalps dangling from their bridles, as well as an assortment of other body parts, ears, noses, teeth, even fingers, all vivid trophies attesting to their latest victims. In one massacre, a Quantrill chieftain calmly hopped from one body to another, plundering his prey. Altogether, he stepped on 124 corpses. In another massacre, those who surrendered were clubbed to death, and others were pinned to the ground with bloody bayonets, their entrails spilling onto the ground. Wounded men were actually far luckier. They met death more quickly. Why? Their throats were slit. Those waiting were the least lucky. They were forced to watch until their turn came. Only later were they then bloodily killed. "The war has furnished no greater barbarism," wrote one horrified Union general. Said another, "These men are heartless and merciless fiends." Nor did it end there. All order broke down. groups of revenge-minded Federals, militia, and even soldiers became guerrillas themselves, angrily stalking Missouri, tormenting, torturing, and slaying Southern sympathizers. Ruthless reprisals and random terror became the norm, and the entire state was dragged into an incomprehensible and accelerating whirlpool of vengeance. New and no less bloodthirsty gangs of bushwhackers rose up, led by George Todd, John Thrailkill, and others who roved virtually unchecked, baiting federal patrols and murdering them, harassing the locals and terrorizing them, and bringing all affairs in Missouri to a halt. Routinely, trains were stopped and attacked. So were stage lines. Steamboats, too, were not safe, coming under repeated sniper fire. To run the gauntlet on the Missouri, pilots started to request and received $1,000 for a single trip to Kansas. Petrified, Unionists ran, abandoning their houses and their farms and converging on fortified towns. Actually, by now they were garrisoned, which were reduced to nothing more than isolated enclaves in a sea of death. For their part, soldiers were pinned down at their posts in a countryside dominated by guerrillas, their men as much hunted as hunters. The lawlessness continued, as did the carnage. Every 2 or 3 days, a new corpse would be found floating in the river. "The very air seems charged with blood and death," wrote one Kansas City editor. Indeed, it was. Missouri was something that had never been witnessed before on American soil, and the Union was almost utterly unable to cope with the ongoing terror. Federal policies were at once muddled, incoherent, and ineffective. A collective sociopathy reigned in Missouri. The very fabric of all civil society was torn apart. All morals disintegrated. Both sides snapped. And the true victims, of course, were the civilians. Squeezed between the two warring parties, civilians became not just anxious spectators but unwilling participants. In a war without fronts, boundaries, and formal organization, the divisions between civilians and soldiers' partisans almost totally evaporated. Those who sheltered the guerrillas, and there were many of them, anti-Union farmers, their wives, even their children regularly spied for the guerrillas, placed their lives in peril. So did those who collaborated with the Unionists. Unsigned notes were ominously pinned to doors. "You are a damn Yankee. Leave or your life will forfeit." They got the message. So did those whom the Union pressured. It was not unheard of for civilians to undergo a torture ritual at the hands of one or the other, or even both sides. A favorite tactic was a barbaric kind of repetitive hanging. One father, as his family watched helplessly, was strung up 3 times, and only on the last try was the deed done. In others, son was walked to the noose some 7 times before he met his untimely fate. And there was torture by other means. Toenails would be pulled off, one by one. Knives would be thrust into bellies, but only partially. Houses would be burned, and on and on and on. To survive, people cheated, lied, acted duplicitously, and bore false witness against their neighbors, anything to appease the other side. In time, whole communities were torn apart. Neutrality became impossible. In the words of historian Michael Fellman, it became a life of secret impeachments, divided loyalties, and whispered confidences. Every bit as ominous, as one observer noted, the enemy was everywhere and everyone. Guerrillas dressed as Union men and Union men as guerrillas. And just as often as not, Missourians had no idea who was terrorizing them. Was it the friendly Virginian down the road? The drunken Kentuckian who ran the local grocery? a furtive stranger, a union man, or a bushwhacker. Soon, townsfolk couldn't trust their own neighbors, not even those they had known for years. The smallest hick in speech came to mean something ominous. The slightest arched eyebrow would be feared. And so, too, in this pervasive atmosphere of paranoia, were one's own very senses. Union troops fared little better. In most instances, their deaths came at the hands of some unseen sniper. So they, also, trusted no one. All civilians were seen as enemies. As such, many were wrongly robbed, tortured, maimed, and, of course, killed. As time wore on, ever greater numbers of people fled to Texas, Colorado, California, Oregon, Idaho, even Tennessee. By 1864, most rural Missourians had become refugees, inside or outside the state. For those stalwarts who stayed, a form of psychic numbing took over. "We hear of some outrage every day," blithely confessed one Missourian. Wrote the Kansas City Journal of Commerce in 1864, even before the worst of it, "East of us, west of us, north of us, south of us, comes the same harrowing story. Pandemonium itself seems to have broken loose, and robbery, murder and rapine, and death run riot over the country." One Union general said it perhaps most poignantly. There was something in the hearts of good and typical Christians which had exploded. In Richmond, the Confederacy was watching these events carefully. Early in the war, in an attempt to tap the growing discontent behind enemy lines, the Confederate government had legitimized guerrilla organizations with the Partisan Ranger Act of April 1862. Yet ironically, as time went by, and even as the roaming guerrillas tied down Union troops and Union energy that might have been employed elsewhere, a number of Confederate authorities found the guerrillas' methods distasteful. To the chivalric Southerners, war was about noble sacrifice. It was to be gentlemanly and Christian, and there was an aristocratic code of honor to be adhered to. Typically, when most rebel generals thought of guerrillas, they thought of Mosby. But when it came to the guerrilla war in Missouri, a number of high-ranking Confederates found their methods repugnant. It was one thing to kill Yankees in battle. It was another thing to bushwhack and kill innocent civilians. As such, Richmond's official policy was of two minds. It found guerrillas distasteful, dishonorable, offensive to the civilized sensibilities of the South, yet it willingly exploited or turned a blind eye to the guerrillas nonetheless. Moreover, there was some public support. As the Richmond Times-Dispatch editorialized in 1863, "Let the guerrilla system be thoroughly carried out. Let's exact an eye for an eye and a life for a life." By 1864, however, because of the heightened numbers of atrocities committed by bushwhackers in the West, as well as the penchant for plunder that virtually all guerrilla bands displayed, powerful Southern voices eventually called for repeal of the Partisan Ranger Act. They argued that irregular warfare was barbaric, too often uncontrollable, even injurious to the cause. Finally, in early 1865, the Confederate Congress revoked the act, and the government ended its sanction of all partisan groups with two notable exceptions: Mosby's Rangers in the North and McNeil's partisans in Western Virginia. Robert E. Lee himself had come to harbor considerable doubts about the bushwhackers and was instrumental in the Congress's decision. Yet on that fateful morning of April 9, 1865, Lee had two very different faces of guerrilla war to consider. The first was the face of a Mosby and a Morgan, and should he authorize a full-scale guerrilla conflict, such exceptional cavalrymen as Nathan Bedford Forrest, along with so many other of his loyal soldiers. Beyond that, there was the shining example of his own Carolina ancestors against the British Lord Cornwallis. Or, alternatively, there was the anarchic, scarlet-stained face of Missouri. In all likelihood, a guerrilla war countrywide would be a combination of the two, and, even at this late date, it could likely have an awesome impact. Total conquest could be resisted until, perhaps, attrition and exhaustion would lead the North to sue the South for peace. Political genius, Otto von Bismarck once instructed, entails hearing the far-off hoofbeat of history and then rising to catch the galloping horsemen by the coattails. The difficulty, of course, is that one may hear the wrong horse or leap after the wrong horseman. Was this to be Lee's fate? In his time, he had arguably been justified in choosing his state over his Union. He had surely been right about countless battles, from Chancellorsville to the Seven Days Battle, from the Wilderness to Cold Harbor. He had equally been right, however belatedly, about inducting slaves into the Confederate Army with the promise of emancipation. However, for all his strategic acumen, he had not been right about the ability of the South to win its independence outright, whether through a war of maneuver and attack, or through prolonged attrition while hoping for foreign intervention. Lee was sophisticated enough to know that the drum of history rarely beats for the men on the losing side in wars. Few achieve lasting greatness. Fewer still are venerated in civic halls and school kids' history lessons. Thus, it was here that Lee was confronted with one last chance, one last opportunity for vindication. If he were somehow to succeed with guerrilla warfare, his place in history would be assured. The temptation must have been vast. No one should think otherwise. Moreover, it must be added that Lee himself was not always a model of absolute consistency. Throughout the war, a number of his key views evolved. In 1862, for instance, when the Confederacy rightly feared that Richmond might be overrun, Lee, with tears in his eyes, angrily told Jefferson Davis, "Richmond must not be given up. It shall not be given up." By 1865, however, he was thinking exactly the opposite. So, as a sleep-deprived Robert E. Lee, now unable to move west or south or east, only north, the very last direction he wanted to go in, listened to one of his most trusted advisors in the cool early morning hours of April 9. Hearing Porter Alexander out, he was doing some quick calculations in his head about the effect that generations of bushwhacking, guerrilla warfare, would have on the country. Lee, however, principled to the bitter end, was thinking not about personal glory, but along quite different lines. What is honorable? What is proper? What is right? Likely recalling Missouri, he quickly reasoned that a guerrilla war would make a wasteland of all that he loved. Brother would be set against brother, not just for 4 years, but for generations. Such a war would surely destroy Virginia, and just as surely destroy the country as well. Even if it worked, and perhaps especially if it worked. For Lee, that was too high a price to pay. No matter how much he believed in the cause, his daring attempts over the last 9 days were vivid testimony to that. There were limits to Southern independence. As he had once said, "It is better to do right, even if we suffer in so doing, than to incur the reproach of our consciences and posterity." But Lee, more so than most other generals, also shunned making political decisions. He was uncompromising about the unique American ethos of respecting the primacy of civilian leadership to make judgments about affairs of state. Yet this was surely a weighty political decision if ever there were one. if he were to surrender his troops, it would be against the advice of Jefferson Davis, against the advice of his civilian authority. But on that Palm Sunday morning of April 9, he forged ahead. Suppose, he told Porter Alexander, that I should take your suggestion. The men would be without rations and under no control of officers. They would be compelled to rob and steal in order to live. They would become bands of marauders, and the enemy's cavalry would overrun many sections they may never have occasion to visit. No, said the old commander. We would bring on a state of affairs it would take the country years to recover from. He continued his counsel to Alexander. Then, General, you and I as Christian men have no right to consider only how this would affect us. We must, he stressed, consider its effect on the country as a whole. Finally, Lee said, and as for myself, you young fellows might go bushwhacking, but the only dignified course for me would be to go to General Grant and surrender myself and take the consequences of my acts. Thus did Robert E. Lee, so revered for his leadership in war, make his most historic contribution to peace. By this one momentous decision, he spared the country the divisive guerrilla warfare that surely would have followed, a vile and poisonous conflict that would not only have delayed any true national reconciliation for many years to come, but in all probability would have fractured the country for decades into warring military pockets, or, as Tom Wicker has deftly put it, ensured the Vietnamization of America. Nor is it idle to speculate that even at such a late date, such a mode of warfare might well have accomplished what 4 years of conventional war had failed to do: cleave North from South. None of this, of course, is to say that Lee made his decision without an inner struggle. For several days now, Lee had been vacillating among ending the hostilities, waging last-ditch attempts at escaping, and dying at his post. Just that morning, gloomily staring off into the distance, into the lifting mist, he had cried out, "How easily I could be rid of all this and be at rest! I have only to ride along the line, and all will be over." But as Lee weighed honor and glory against duty and will, the latter trumped the former. He had already told his immediate staff with a heavy heart, "Then there is nothing left for me to do but to go and see General Grant, and I would rather die 1,000 deaths. Poignantly, while tears and grief enveloped his men, he would add, "It is our duty to live." At 10 o'clock, Robert E. Lee promptly presented himself for his appointment with the Union commander. Dismounting, he stood tall under a flag of truce and, for the first time ever in his long career, in full view of Grant's army. But a new concern arose. With good reason, one of Lee's aides feared that another attack was in the offing. At that very moment, intermittent firing was heard off in the distance. And when federal couriers finally arrived, there was no Grant, only his letter asserting that the morning meeting between the two would lead to no good. Lee carefully scanned the message, reflected for a few moments, and told his military secretary, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Marshall, the grandnephew of the renowned Supreme Court jurist, "Well, write a letter to General Grant and ask him to meet me to deal with the question of the surrender of my army," in reply to the letter he wrote me at Farmville. With that one succinct sentence, Lee had now accepted Grant's terms. Marshall handed the letter to a federal officer and told him the message required a suspension of hostilities. No was the answer. That could not be. An attack had already been ordered, and the officer didn't have the authority to stop it. Nor could a message be gotten in time to Grant. Lee still stood under the flag of truce. the federal soldier requested that he withdraw. Instead, Lee began writing, again, to Grant. 9th April, 1865. General, I ask a suspension of hostilities pending the adjustment of the terms of the surrender of this army, in the interview requested in my former communication today. Very respectfully, your obedient servant, R. E. Lee, General. Once more, Lee was warned to leave immediately. He now stood directly in the path of an oncoming federal advance. With blue columns a mere 100 yards away, the scene was a farrago of confusion and potential danger. His tired face set, jaw locked, soft eyes expressionless, Lee eventually mounted Traveler and rode back to his own rear guard. Finally, shortly after 11 o'clock, word came that the Union had authorized a ceasefire. Once again, Lee mounted his horse and made his way to the front, where he penned his third letter of the day to U.S. Grant. Headquarters, Army of Northern Virginia, 9th April, 1865. General, I sent a communication to you today from the picket line whither I had gone in the hopes of meeting you in pursuance of the request continued in my letter of yesterday. Major General Meade informs me that it would probably expedite matters to send a duplicate through some other part of your lines. I therefore request an interview at such time and place as you may designate, to discuss the terms of the surrender of this army in accordance with your offer to have such an interview contained in your letter of yesterday. Very respectfully, your obedient servant, R. E. Lee, General. For this scion of the First Family of Virginia, these were undoubtedly moments of soaring anxiety and deep depression. From that day on, everything would be different. No longer would he be considered a noble Confederate patriot or a revered Southern George Washington. Instead, he would be ignominiously known as a failed revolutionary and, to many in the North, an abettor of treason. Already, when he rose to dress that morning, he had donned his full general's uniform, including a fine red silk sash, a gleaming, jeweled, and engraved sword, and a pair of handsome thread gloves. "I have probably to be General Grant's prisoner today," he later explained to his men, "and I thought I must make my best appearance." And as the morning wore on, he increasingly feared the harsh terms that Grant might impose. But what exactly did that mean? Lee himself left no lasting record, although we do know that as he rode with Longstreet around midday, he talked about the possibilities for some time, often mumbling in half-sentences and fragments. While he at first thought that Grant might give good terms, he was now clearly growing anxious. Indeed, beyond anticipating becoming the North's prisoner, he had no real way of knowing what would happen once the two sides met. And what Lee did know at that moment about other failed revolutionaries could not have been terribly reassuring. In fact, on its face, much of Western history, a world with which he was closely acquainted, now seemed to conspire against him. King Charles I was beheaded in the English Civil War, the precursor to the American Revolutionary War, and to some extent, this Civil War as well. During the French Revolution, their version of the American Civil War, the young leader Robespierre led thousands of the French aristocracy, the Ancien Régime, to the guillotine until his own neck met the blade. Lee had just rejected guerrilla warfare out of his sense of being a good Christian. But throughout centuries of European Christendom, a history in which Lee was well steeped, the bodies of rebellious, treasonous men and women were routinely tied, or sometimes outright nailed, to the stake and slowly roasted alive. The more fortunate, not those who begged for their lives, most knew better, were merely beheaded. Nor were the well-bred aristocracy, the refined nobility, the high-minded priests and much-beloved generals, men of Lee's lofty station, spared when treason was suspected or proven. In their case, the punishment was severe and quite public. Nobles, archbishops, bishops, princes, dukes, margraves, and military men were routinely drawn and quartered, after which their reeking, bleeding cadavers, cut into four parts, were put on public display to rot as a warning for all who contemplated rebellion. More recently, the famed General Napoleon had met a far more merciful end, though one that would hardly have seemed attractive to Lee. This general, emperor, and one-time national hero was banished to the distant Atlantic island of St. Helena to live out his final years in ignominy. So too did numerous others meet death or exile after the revolutionary tide of 1848 that swept the entire European continent. In short, bloody executions and harsh revenge were as ordinary then as they are considered extraordinary today. And in America, across this troubled landscape of retribution, there was again not necessarily much in the way of consolation for Lee. Lee had the unique distinction of being the man who would capture John Brown, the revolutionary abolitionist, at Harper's Ferry. Brown was summarily hanged for treason. And while Lee rode Traveler to meet Grant, his own aides shared his unspoken anxiety. Upon surrender, the men feared they could be summarily marched off into confinement camps as prisoners of war. Porter Alexander later confessed that he expected all of them to be paraded through the streets of the North, humiliated, hooted at, disgraced. And, of course, there was the grim example of the fate of Bill Anderson, the rebel bushwhacker who was killed in the most horrible way. His head was cut off with an axe by revenge-minded Unionists and mounted atop a telegraph pole for all to see. And on this day, though Lee remained unaware, the fall of Richmond had already brought a spate of stinging calls for revenge, a grisly, thundering, roaring refrain, chanted and chanted again in an ever-rising crescendo, coming from New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, and of course, Washington. "Burn it! Burn it! Let her burn!" they cried about Richmond. On treason. "Treason is the highest crime known in the catalog of crimes, and for him that is guilty of it, I would say death is too easy a punishment." On Jefferson Davis. "Hang him! Hang him! Yes, I say hang him 20 times. On the Confederates who had graduated from West Point. "Those who have been fed, clothed, and taught at the public expense ought to stretch the first rope." On those who had lifted their hands against the North. "Treason must be made odious. Traitors must be punished and impoverished. I would arrest them. I would try them. I would convict them. And I would hang them." On pardons. "Never, never." And on Lee himself, a chorus cried, "Hang Lee! Hang Lee! Hang Lee!" Indeed, the Chicago Tribune had recommended just that. But as Lee waited anxiously, another man was riding furiously toward the surrender. Lee had no idea what he looked like, no idea whether his eyes radiated warmth or anger, no clue as to whether they were filled with reconciliation or with retribution. But this man, a man alternately known by many names, as Victor, after King Victor Emmanuel II of Italy, or Ulysses, after the great Greek figure, or Tex, to his boyhood chums, or Lys, to his close friends, or Duty, to his wife, or Unconditional Surrender, for his war achievements, or, most notoriously, as the Butcher, by his own people, for his indifferent ability to send wave after wave of men into battle to die, would today decide Lee's own fate and that of his men. And now, on a spring afternoon at a small stagecoach stop, U.S. Grant, who had earlier made no bones about his intention to punish Lee and his army, would take on a most unlikely new mantle, statesman. Chapter 4, The Meeting. Now at last, with Lee making his way to surrender, the hour has struck for U.S. Grant. It has been a long time coming. He has been waiting not just for many, many months, but for several years. It has been an excruciating journey. In the service of his country, he has hurled his men into battle like giant hunks of fresh meat, knowing that everything depended upon the force of arms. He has endured slander and calumny when the situation seemed hopeless to nearly everyone except himself and Abraham Lincoln. He has embodied an icy resolve to see this war through when the northern voices of accommodation were at their greatest. And even in the grimmest of hours, when northern defeat seemed possible, when there appeared to be no other choice but to make an imperfect peace with the Confederacy, when the sheer costs of war no longer seemed worth it, the inscrutable Grant looked up and somehow always saw victory. In countless ways, Grant couldn't have been more different from the adversary who was now preparing to throw himself at his mercy. Where Lee was tall and stately, Grant was stubby and rumpled. Where Lee was a mature man who had already lived most of his life, he was 58, Grant was actually quite young, an astonishing mere 43. Where the patrician Lee was in many ways an American of the 18th century, closer in spirit and outlook to the founders, the plebeian Grant was decisively of the 19th century, tied to the dynamic strings of the future, to the capitalists, the unionists, the speculators, the doers, and in time to the political functionaries and party men. Where both men were cunning and ruthless in war, Lee the warrior, however fierce in battle, was actually tender in human relations, passionate with his loved ones, florid in his southern speech. Grant, by contrast, was sensitive, but he never showed it. He was crisp in demeanor and crisp in spirit, speaking in blunt, lean sentences, barking out incontrovertible orders in his soft, musical voice, never indulging, publicly or privately, in excessive sentimentality, almost never doubting or second-guessing himself. Lee disciplined his emotions. Grant repressed them, or drank. Lee had a sublimely romantic quality about him. He was a figure who gave his men heroic visions of what they wore and what they could become, was a testament to sweet humor and loyalty and duty and the ultimate virtue of action, and was a true tragedian who understood his own appeal to his followers. Grant was cut from a very different cloth. He was in many ways the quintessential utilitarian, a man less of the refined South, or the elite East, for that matter, than of the gritty West. He talks bad grammar, one Grant aide slyly quipped, but talks it naturally. A man fired by a deep-seated conviction and a confidence that could belong only to someone who had failed in life time and time again, until midway through the Civil War, when he found what he knew was somehow his destiny. And this, by dreary force of deeds in war rather than sheer charisma or some indefinable presence, was how he inspired his men, his army, and his president. Yet if history was now beckoning for Grant, it hadn't always. Just 4 years earlier, Grant had been an unsuccessful soldier turned shabby and solvent Midwestern civilian, known only for the persistence of his failures. Little in his family background or early career suggested he would amount to much. In fact, his name wasn't even U.S. Grant. It was Hiram Ulysses. He did come from a solid American pedigree. His ancestry dated back to Matthew and Priscilla Grant, a Puritan couple who arrived in 1630 aboard the Mary Ann John. Back then, the Grants were affluent and prestigious members of colonial society. That is, until Noah Grant, more than a century later, was killed in the French and Indian Wars. The family fortunes quickly declined, and the third Noah Grant, Ulysses' grandfather, was later jailed in a debtor's prison. Grant's father, Jesse, did a bit better, running a successful tannery in Point Pleasant, Ohio, and later becoming the local Whig mayor of Georgetown. As a boy, Hiram Grant was a curious mixture of insecurities and talents. He was withdrawn in public and tongue-tied around people, yet he was wonderful around horses, riding them with grace and alacrity. The vile stench of his father's tannery was one of his earliest and more formative memories. Ironically, it imbued him with a profound distaste for blood, and for most of his life he would refuse to eat any type of meat that wasn't fully charred. Moreover, of all things, it was cruelty to animals that sent him into a wild rage. It also gave him a horror of dirt. As a general, he was so fastidious, some might argue prissy, that he lugged around in his headquarters a collapsible rubber bath. Using his influence, Jesse Grant got his short, scrawny son a congressional appointment to West Point in 1839, trusting that the Army would provide him with some direction and earn him a solid living. It didn't. At the military academy, Grant discovered that a clerk had mistakenly written down his name as Ulysses Simpson Grant, and instead of insisting on a correction, the insecure Grant just shrugged his shoulders and submissively accepted it as his own. He was an unremarkable cadet. "A military life holds no charms for me," he lamented, "and I had not the faintest idea of staying in the Army, even if I should be graduated, which I didn't expect. Who read romantic novels rather than study hard, could never quite keep in step with the rhythm of marching or compare with the stylish demeanor of the more refined Eastern and Southern boys, and actually prayed that a resolution introduced in Congress to abolish West Point would pass." Contrary to his worst fears, though, he did graduate, but only a lackluster 21st in a class of 39, and he later failed to get the cavalry duty he so ardently wanted. His only real enthusiasm seemed to be for riding and watercolors. His friends called him Uncle Sam Grant, then Uncle Sam, then Country Sam, and finally, just plain old Sam. While he believed that James Polk's Mexican War was wicked and one of the most unjust ever waged by a stronger against a weaker nation, he did his duty nevertheless. He fought bravely as a regimental quartermaster, at one point riding through enemy fire, likened to a hailstorm, to bring ammunition to his men. In 1848, he married Julia Dent, the sister of his West Point roommate and the daughter of a Missouri slave owner. They would have three sons and a daughter. Subsequently, the Army dispatched Grant to a Pacific station without them. He was sickened and secluded, and it turned into a disaster. He could not even earn enough money to send his family west. His fortunes quickly slid. A grocery venture collapsed, and so did a plan to raise potatoes. His savings started to waste away. While he had taken the oath as a son of temperance, he began to drink heavily, usually on 2 or 3 day sprees. In 1854, it cost him dearly. Caught drunk on duty, he was faced with the prospect of resigning or being court-martialed. Grant took the lesser of the evils, quit in disgrace, and went back east to rejoin Julia and work a piece of land that his father-in-law gave him. In a sarcastic swipe at the wealthy families who gave their homes noble-sounding names, he betrayed his lingering insecurities, calling his place Hardscrabble Farm. Hardscrabble it was. Even when he used two slaves to help with the work, he could not make a go of it. Poverty now stared him in the face, and he appealed to his father for financial assistance. He was rebuffed. Business suited him no better. He tried his hand at bill collecting, then real estate, and even hawked firewood on the St. Louis streets from his boxy wagon, still wearing his faded blue army overcoat. All failed. One Christmas, he was reduced to pawning his gold watch and chain to buy family presents. Eventually, before he hit rock bottom, his father bailed him out, giving him a job clerking in his leather store in Galena, Illinois. Grant's older brother was his boss. There, he amiably passed the time, analyzing politics with his pal John Rollins, keeping the store books, and collecting his modest check, $800 a year. By all accounts, he was slovenly, unsoldier-like, a man of little reputation and little promise, hardly the stuff of which gladiators are made. Then came the war. Grant, a staunch unionist, quickly reenlisted. He wrote to the Secretary of War politely asking for a command. His letter was never opened. Nor did the Army itself see fit to give the returning officer a post. George McClellan deemed himself much too busy and much too important even to see him. Finally, his own governor appointed him as a colonel of a volunteer regiment, the worst in Illinois. Grant never looked back. He triumphed in a little battle at Belmont, Missouri, then another one at Fort Henry, then a magnificent one at Fort Donelson, all while other federal generals were being thrashed one after another. Soon, Grant was promoted to brigadier general and became a northern hero. His picture even appeared on the cover of Harper's Magazine. In truth, he hardly looked heroic, or all that much like an up-and-comer. Harkening back to his bitter West Point years, he still disliked uniforms, liked military marching bands even less, and boasted he could recognize only two tunes. One was Yankee Doodle, and the other wasn't. But for all his unpretentiousness, he also, shrewdly, reinvented his persona, smartly trimming his beard, giving up his pipe for his trademark cigar, and calmly whittling on a stick while battles were in progress. And he had retained his old innate genius for reading maps. But all was not smooth sailing. Despite the watchful eye of his old neighbor and newly appointed Army Chief of Staff, John Rollins, Grant would on occasion backslide and take to the bottle. And when his army was caught by surprise at Shiloh in 1862 and suffered fearful losses, Grant was ignominiously labeled a drunk and branded an incompetent. It was said he fed men heartlessly into the sausage machine of battle. Ohio even disclaimed him, asserting that he had been born in Illinois. The tide of public opinion now turned sharply against him. Merritt Halstead, editor of the influential Cincinnati Commercial, wrote that General Grant is a jackass in the original package. He is a poor, drunken imbecile. Grant will fail miserably, hopelessly, eternally. Charles Dana, sent by Lincoln to spy on Grant, despite coming to like the general, was ultimately not a whole lot more charitable. Not a great man, he reported, not original or brilliant, though he acknowledged that Grant was sincere, morally great, and gifted with courage that never failed. Eventually, A.K. McClure, the influential Republican leader and Pennsylvania Magazine publisher, went to Lincoln and clamored for Grant's head. "I can't spare this man," the president protested. "He fights." And fight Grant did, becoming the hero not just of Donelson, but of Vicksburg, one of the most important strategic northern victories, which helped cut the Confederacy cleanly in two, and of Chattanooga, and then becoming the first man to hold the rank of lieutenant general since George Washington. But when Grant again suffered frightful losses to Lee in the Wilderness and at Cold Harbor and the mortification of the crater at Petersburg, new calls for his head arose. Plain-spoken, detached, cool, the no-nonsense Grant nonetheless continued to plug away. He was rarely a man for small talk, or for that matter, the cut and thrust of military politics or public opinion, but he was savvy enough to cultivate his most important constituency of one, Abe Lincoln. "I think Grant has hardly a friend left except myself," Lincoln observed, adding, "But What I want is generals who will fight battles and win victories. Grant has done this, and I propose to stand by him. Like Lincoln, and Lee for that matter, Grant believed in taking risks. Also like Lincoln, he believed in attacking the enemy's army rather than passively maneuvering to capture places. And like Lincoln, when the chips were down, he quietly thumbed his nose at the opposition and kept his eye on the goal. And that goal was always to crush the enemy. In a thousand little ways, it seemed as though Grant was fated to fight the Civil War. In battle, what galled Grant most was indecision. Once, an aide asked if he thought he was always right. "No," Grant ripped back, "I am not. But in war, anything is better than indecision. We must decide. If I am wrong, we shall soon find it out and can do the other thing. But not to decide may ruin everything." He was never a whiner. He didn't plead for reinforcements. Seldom did he lapse into excuses, and he almost never argued with his colleagues. In the end, what mattered most was doing the job. And as his soldiers were disemboweled by Lee's men, blown into fragments, writhed with agonizing wounds, or were slowly roasted to death, Grant was unchastened. For Grant, casualties of war were no primitive aberration. Conflict, not amity, was the way of the world and, regrettably, the way to peace. He intuitively understood this. One of the harder questions about Grant, so often called the butcher, was whether he secretly enjoyed war too much. In fact, he was no lover of the panoply of war, of the bugles, the drums, the battle flags. And while he took terrible losses in such deafening stride, as though he were little more than a seasoned broker calculating the Wall Street markets, or a farmer warily eyeing the weather, he often stayed away from the battlefield itself so that his compassion would not sap his resolve. For Grant, this battle, this fight, this war was prosaically called the business. The description is apt. One observer put it best, saying of Grant, "His expression is as if he had determined to drive his head through a brick wall and was about to do it." Noted another, "Grant may possess the talisman." Of necessity, generals inhabit the political world as much as the battlefield, but Grant had the good sense not to let his fame go to his head. His star rose and fell again. In March 1864, this short, round-shouldered, scared-looking man charmed official and social Washington. The refined diplomats, the busy socialites, the inquisitive clerks, the gossipy matrons, and the war-weary senators, as did no one else in the Union, including Lincoln himself. In the words of one awed congressman, Grant was the idol of the hour. But this love and adulation were fleeting, and at least then he seemed instinctively to know it. His job was to prosecute the war, not to let newspaper clips go to his head, and once his mind was made up about how to fight this war, he would not budge. Thus his famous line, "I will fight Lee if it takes all summer." Thus his guiding maxim, articulated after Shiloh, "I gave up all hope of saving the Union except by complete conquest." Thus his stoic proclamation in the Wilderness Campaign, "Whatever happens, there will be no turning back." Grant had a kind of built-in shock absorber that permitted him in life and in war to survive the setbacks, the defeats, the humiliations, and, of course, the heartbreaking number of deaths. One cannot help but be struck by his tenacious resolve, his detached yet tightly focused energy, his unwavering determination and gritty pugnacity. But none of this is to say he was indifferent. Peel back his shy, composed demeanor, and you find a core of cold steel. But there is little doubt that beneath the outwardly calm exterior that he projected to the world, he suffered from profound anxiety. The signs were all there. It wasn't just the episodic binge drinking, but the unbearable migraine headaches that necessitated chloroform treatments, the sleeplessness, the physical illnesses that manifested considerable emotional strain. Still, he knew what he wanted. In the hundreds of war photographs of Grant, you can glimpse multiple expressions and many sentiments, but one. He never looks defeated. This couldn't have been easy, even for a man of Grant's iron disposition. Perhaps the most poignant and telling moment of Grant's generalship was that fateful evening in the wilderness after Lee's massive drubbing. If ever there was a turning point in the war, it was this. Grant, the butcher, retreating to his tent, falling face down on his cot, and apparently bawling like a baby. Then, the next morning, he got up to face the battle again. 5 other Union generals had already seen their fates and their futures destroyed, McClellan's twice, by the fierce general in gray confronting them. And however much 20th century military analysts may point out that, as a percentage of his army, Grant did not necessarily lose that many more men than Lee, the indelible reality was that the losses of his army were colossally huge, more men, in fact, than Lee had in his entire army at the time. That spring evening, as Union men died and moaned in the maze of swamps and streams and hills, and as Grant was sunk in gloom, he now clearly stood alone. Mired in despair, he had to ask himself, how many casualties were enough? For even as hardened a man as Grant, one must wonder, could this have been anything other than the decision of a lifetime? What did he do? He reached deep within himself and found the inner metal not to become the 6th casualty of Robert E. Lee. He would press on, he decided, as fateful a decision as any he made until that time, the siege of Vicksburg included. Even after Cold Harbor, an assault he regretted more than any he had ever ordered, there would be no turning back, no retreat, no sign of weakness. The crucial question, of course, during that summer of 1864 was not what policy to pursue toward the South, not what to do once the war was won, but whether it would be won at all. But to his everlasting credit, as he fought that enemy who, in his words, repeatedly demonstrated Herculean deeds of valor, Grant never considered that it could be otherwise. Yet on the morning of April 9, 1865, when the first of Lee's letters reached him as he rode along the river on his way to meet Sheridan at Appomattox, his migraine still pounding away at his brain, an even harder set of questions was raised. What terms would he impose upon Lee? How did he intend to prosecute the settlement? Would the man who had found his way only in war know how to navigate through the equally treacherous terrain of surrender and peace? If all the world knew about what was in Grant's head, it would now find a very different side of this general, what was also in his heart. In no small measure, no greater question had ever gripped the country during these 4 years of war. Most civil wars, in fact, end quite badly, and history is rife with lessons that how wars end is every bit as crucial as why they start and how they are waged. The beginning of the end would now be decided at Appomattox Courthouse. Earlier in the year, in March, after Lee had felt Grant out over the general issue of peace, Lincoln had bluntly sent Grant a clear, uncompromising order. I will deal with political questions and negotiate for peace. Your job is to fight. Nonetheless, on this day Grant would evince a deft political and diplomatic touch, even as he appeared apolitical. And if it were Lincoln's fervent desire to press the conflict harshly while then making a gentle peace, it fell to Grant to make good on that promise. Hindsight should not obscure the potential minefield that Grant was walking into as Lee's correspondence was handed to him that morning. With a cigar in his mouth and quiet satisfaction on his face, the pain in my head seemed to leave me the moment I got Lee's letter, Grant noted. He read Lee's letter and handed it to his aide, Rawlins. You had better read it aloud, General, Grant averred. His voice dipping with emotion, Rawlins complied, and a delicious shudder swept through their ranks. But when Rawlins finished, Grant fell silent. His countenance now inscrutable, he immediately sat down on a grassy bank and composed his reply. April 9, 1865. General R.E. Lee, commanding CSA. General, your note of this date is but this moment, 11:50 a.m., received, in consequence of my having passed from the Richmond and Lynchburg Road to Farmersville and Lynchburg Road. I am at this writing about 4 miles west of Walker's Church and will push forward to the front for the purpose of meeting you. Notice sent to me on this road where you wish the interview to take place. Very respectfully, your obedient servant, U.S. Grant, Lieutenant General. The ultimate fate of nations is often measured and swayed not by large events, but by tiny ones. Small symbolic gestures that shape men's passions, assuage or incite their fears, and quell or inflame lingering hostilities for years to come. On its own, it would be ludicrous to claim that John Brown's raid caused the Civil War, just as it would be nonsense to assert that Lincoln's election was anything more than a proximate cause. Such events are catalysts, sparks, symbols that ignite a series of chain reactions on the much longer, more rutted road to war. But, by the same token, there are also moments that can act as catalysts for peace. Whatever fears Lee may have harbored that morning about Grant's terms, the Union General's first gesture was astonishingly conciliatory and far-sighted. Having defeated the gallant Army of Northern Virginia, U.S. Grant was letting his vaunted foe, Robert E. Lee, choose the time and place of his surrender. However seemingly insignificant, it was a remarkable act that, like Grant himself, spoke simply yet clearly. The North may defeat the Confederate armies, it may strip away their guns and remove their cannons, but if Grant was going to have anything to do with it, it would not also destroy their dignity. Grant, normally so calm in war and composed in a crisis, later confessed that he was rather nervous about finally meeting Lee, and he now spurred quickly forward to the impending rendezvous. He would have to ride 16 miles. For his part, an exhausted Lee, awake since well before dawn, lay under a nearby apple tree and took a short nap. By all accounts, he still hadn't eaten a morsel of food. He was exhausted, stunned, and even more so depressed. This would be the worst ordeal of his life, but he felt a solemn obligation to perform it just the same. Stirred within the hour by Grant's staff officer bearing the Union General's request, Lee raised himself up, promptly scanned it, and quickly dispatched an aide to find a suitable meeting place for surrender. As the blazing yellow sun climbed high overhead, the winding country lanes and the rural stillness of Appomattox couldn't have appeared less suited to capturing the smoldering moment about to take place. Told to find a suitable house where Lee could meet with Grant, Lee's aide found instead a drowsy village with broad grassy flanks, a small thicket of tall oaks and broad pine trees, a single unnamed street, and an erratic pathway meandering from and around the town center. Though Appomattox Courthouse had been a county seat since 1845, it was hard to envision much happening in this remote Southside Virginia town comprising 20 or so simple structures quietly hugging the land. A half dozen clapboard hutch houses, several small stores, a once busy tavern, the courthouse itself, and one handsome red brick home. Since 1819, Appomattox had been best known as a way station for travelers on the Richmond-Lynchburg stage road, where the weary may do at the Clover Hill Tavern and Guest House. One can imagine it still as a place where Southerners lounged in the summer heat, where riders tilted back a cool lemonade or a shot of spirits at the bar, or where locals played a raucous game of cards, but not as the epic site where the Army of Northern Virginia would surrender. By 1865, though, the area had become known as a bare and cheerless place. Lee's aide rejected the first house he was ushered into as too dilapidated. Instead, he settled upon the home of Wilmer McLean, freshly built in 1848, bringing a fitting symmetry to battle and surrender. In 1861, McLean had lived near Manassas Junction, on the fields where the Battle of First Manassas, or Bull Run, was fought. His house was a Confederate headquarters until a shell came roaring into his kitchen. A year later, McLean retired to Appomattox to flee from the seemingly permanent emergency of the Civil War, taking up residence in this neat and tidy brick house with its weathered hitching fence, its sweeping covered porch, and its sturdy facade. Now, the war seemed to be waning, and remarkably enough, in his own